one of the common mistakes people, women make this mistake all the time. They will give up anything in a divorce to keep that house. And I don't mean to be sexist, but women fall into this trap way more than men. And then it drives the whole agreement. The whole structure is driven around her desire to keep this house. And it's a very normal, like, I respect that. She's like, this is where my kids grow up. I want to stay here. And then everything gets like wedged into it.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's one of the biggest mistakes people can make. But
right. And I was on the opposite. I was like, I don't want none of this. Right. You know, because I didn't want the house in the first place. I was like, I want this big house. Like, I don't want it. You know, so we were just coming from two different ends of it.
Those are my guests on today's show, Shine the Chef and Ross Ewing, who is a family law attorney. And today we're going to talk about divorce 101, and from three different perspectives, from a therapist standpoint, someone who recently went through divorce, Shine the Chef, and Ross Ewing as a family law attorney. Stay tuned. It's going to be a good one. Right back.
Insights into Relationships and You, hosted by Toby Jenkins, a licensed marriage and family therapist serving Central Kentucky. Each week, Toby will bring you a show with a topic related to mental health, relationships, or self-improvement. The name of the show, Paradigm, comes from that moment in the therapy process when a profound shift in perspective happens for a client. An epiphany, sometimes accompanied by physical reaction that leads them to look at things differently and make significant steps towards improving and enriching their lives.
You are listening to Paradigm, Insights into Relationships and You. I'm your host, Toby Jenkins, and today I have two guests. Shine the Chef, aka Sean Morrison, a frequent guest on the show and a really good friend. And we're honored to have Ross Ewing. And today we are going to have a three-way conversation around divorce, divorce 101. And basically, we're going to talk about divorce from three different perspectives. One, as a marriage and family therapist, I'm often the last stop or the last ditch effort before couples decide that, this relationship, marriage, union is not working anymore. And how do we end things? Ross Ewing, who is a family law attorney, graduate of the University of Kentucky, he is pretty much dedicated his whole professional year to family law. You know, before he came on, I was joking because people often say to me, man, how do you do therapy? And seeing the work that Ross does, how do you do family law? But we'll get into that. So Ross has been in private practice, focused on family law for the last 13 years. In 2017, Ross earned his advanced certificate in divorce and family law mediation from Northwestern University. And now to have this right, Ross, those are the kind of the important things, but you enjoy traveling, hiking, singing, and being in the church choir. Those are kind of the cool things. Because, you know, the work we do is important, but the things we do for fun and that really renew us are really important things. So welcome to the show.
Absolutely. Ross. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, how the heck did you get into family law and being a divorce attorney in the first place?
Yeah. So I wish I had a really snazzy, thoughtful answer. The truth is that when I was in law school, I didn't grow up in a family that had lawyers. I didn't know any lawyers. I felt like a fish out of water. And I had this one wonderful professor named Louise Graham, who was this very lovely Texan. You know, she was a big personality, larger than life, teaching at UK. And she pulled me aside one day and said, you know, sweetie, I think you'd be good at family law. And I was raised to respect gray hair. So I did what this nice old lady said and just kind of put one foot in front of the other. And here I am 13 years later, 15 years later. So.
Wow. Wow. So is that, wow. Cause you know, I was thinking about this before. I don't know about you, Sean. I didn't have a whole lot of exposure to attorneys, and my biggest,
no
influence was, Perry Mason, you know, the original Perry Mason.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Matlock.
Yeah, because my grandmother watched Perry Mason every day. Yeah. So, you know, that's assumed that that's what all attorneys do. They find, they get somebody to confess on the stand. I did it. Right. So that's cool. So I would imagine that this work probably has its ups and downs. We'll probably talk about that too.
Sure. Yeah.
Is often complicated. So, and you know, Sean, from your perspective, how long ago did you go through this process of divorce?
Yeah, wow. So it's 2022. Wow, man, it's been almost 4 years, right?
Yeah.
So it's been an interesting ride post, right? As I've gone through rebuilding myself. You know, in multiple ways, financially, you know, internally, emotionally, that kind of thing. So, yeah, that's, it's been a ride.
Yeah. And that's often the story I get to. You know, I also collected some input from some listeners, and I'll intersperse that through here. But there seems to be some common experiences from it. So, you know, from the outset, it seems like, and I don't have data to back this up, but more of them seem to be pretty painful experiences versus being pleasant experiences. So that's one of the things that we'll kind of walk through. So Ross, kind of walk us through like divorce 101.
Sure. No, that's great. And I will just say wherever this fits in that I think the, one of the reasons I'm so glad to have this opportunity is I think a lot of those upset feelings and a lot of the particularly difficult divorces I see, you know, one of the things that's going on is the person's expectation of what's going to happen does not match what happens at all. You know, and one of the things that, you know, I do a lot of consultations in my office, and some of those people never get divorced. Some people come to me early and they just say, hey, you know, I want to know what it would look like. You know, I want to make an informed choice and have as complete a picture of divorce before I get on this wagon as possible. And I don't know, again, where this fits in the program, but I will just say that I think that's one of the most helpful things people can do, because I tend to see that those folks, even if they go on to get divorced, they go into it with sort of their eyes open, and they don't end up with so blindsided by it, they don't end up shocked by the result. You know, it's something that was, it's just a lot easier for them to process. So I appreciate the opportunity. Sorry, that was my long-winded answer.
But, no, that's fine.
You know,
and that kind of brings up an interesting question. This will probably sound controversial. Well, there are a couple of perspectives. When is the right time to figure out what that picture looks like? Because I have some thoughts, and some of them are controversial. So
yeah,
kind of curious from your perspective, when's the right time?
Keep in mind, my perspective is as somebody who is only going to represent them if they get divorced, right? So I don't, you know, I don't have, and I will say, I'll tell people this early, if you stay married, I make no money ever. And that's fine. Like there's enough people who won't, right? Like there's enough people who will never stay married no matter what. You know, definitely the time to get the information is before anybody moves out, you know, before kids get on a schedule, before you establish any kind of status quo, before you establish any sort of new practice, whether that is like dividing time with kids, dividing bills, dividing any of that. So, you know, people do those things at different times. But I would say the key thing is to get that information before you take any kind of concrete or action towards it. You know, maybe that's when you're in couples therapy, and maybe you haven't said in therapy yet, I don't want to continue this marriage, but maybe in your mind you're thinking, oh, I'm not sure. But yeah, from my perspective as the lawyer, where it gets hard for folks is when there's an established pattern that they then want to disrupt, you know, in the legal process.
Do you see instances where a couple may do that, look at it and see what their picture looks like before they go into that? Or is it usually like they're so upset or whatever that they're trying to sneak behind, you know, sneak away and get a look into that view?
Yeah. So I see both. I will say I will not And again, keep in mind, I'm in Kentucky, so I have the rules for lawyers are different in every state. But in my state, I will not meet with both of them in that initial consultation to give both of them information. I wish, like, if I had all the money in the world, one of the things I would want to do is I would want to have like a consulting nonprofit where people could just come get information about divorce and they could come figure it out. Like, that would thrill me to no end. And if I, again, if I had all the time and the money in the world, we'd have that here. But as their lawyer, ethically, I need to talk to only one of them. But I do think it's good that both of them do it. So, you know, if you hear that your spouse is going to talk to somebody to get some information, I would not want to continue to negotiate that without some information or advice myself. You know, you just want to be on equal footing.
So here's my controversial take. All right, this might give me some trouble because I've been thinking about this a lot. I've been thinking about including this in premarital counseling.
That would be great. No, you know, seriously.
Because back in the day, if you started talking about prenuptial agreements, I was going to ask you what you know about postnuptial agreements.
Oh, yes, yeah. Sure.
And not to say that I expect this relationship reunion to fail, but it's part of being fully informed.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm so glad you said that, because as you were saying that, I was thinking, you know, the people with the prenup have this information from the beginning, right? Some of the, when we circle back to them, I'll talk more about them. But yeah, that is a great way to get information from the outset.
Yeah. So we've got a ton of stuff to jump into. So I'm glad you guys didn't, I haven't said that out loud yet. And actually, I'm working with several couples for premarital, and there are those kind of hairy kind of topics that don't traditionally get included. Previous episode a couple of weeks back was on basically being in the sandwich generation, which is taking care of your kids and your parents at the same time. That I've started to put into premarital counseling, but I think this is a good one because the most recent statistic I saw, I think 2020, there were 2 million marriages, but there were 800,000 divorces. Sure. And so divorce rates kind of hover around. I've been hovering around there since the 70s, so to speak. Yeah. Similar to therapy, I'm assuming from the people I've talked to, Sean, how did you go about finding either a mediator or an attorney to work with?
Yeah, well, in my case, I guess I was kind of quote unquote lucky. Because one of my best friends practices family law, right? So essentially, I called him. We had a conversation, and he gave me some information. The weird thing was, my ex-wife didn't necessarily. She wanted to know, which, to Ross's point, like ethically, he's not supposed to go represent her, and so it kind of it made a little bit of an awkward situation. But I mean, in my case, I think I was very lucky and I didn't try to withhold information from her per se, but I didn't also try to, you know, make that connection between the two of them.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm. Is that how it typically works from your perspective too, Ross?
Yeah, I would say that's lucky is one word. So I actually don't represent my friends. I have a rule against it because I need people to be 120% honest with me when they're in here. I just, you know, Lexington is a big town, but it's a small town too. Mm-hmm. And I don't want, I don't want to worry that folks are holding back or that they're thinking about what I'm going to think if I see them at church or at Walmart or wherever. And so I will mediate for my friends. Like if I know the couple and they're getting divorced and they just need a neutral third party to facilitate a conversation or try to get some kind of agreement, I'll be that person, but I won't take a side just as a rule. It's just, I did it once or twice real early in my career. And oh boy, did I regret that.
Yeah. You can get into some ethical and dual relationship kind of issues there. We're up against our first break. My guest today is Ross Ewing and Shine the Chef, and we're talking about divorce. We'll be right back after this break. This is Toby Jenkins, founder of Jenkins Couples and Family Therapy and host of Paradigm, Insights into Relationships and You. Jenkins Couples and Family Therapy is a proud sponsor and supporter of Paradigm, Insights into Relationships and You. At Jenkins Couples and Family Therapy, we work with couples, families, and individuals walking with you through life's challenges and transitions. You can find out more about Jenkins Couples and Family Therapy and request an appointment through telehealth or in person at www.jenkinscft.com or by calling 859-806-0093. And we are back. You are listening to Paradigm, Insights into Relationships and You. I'm your host, Toby Jenkins. Today, I'm honored to have Ross Ewing, who practices family law in Lexington, Kentucky, and Shine the Chef. And so, you know, before the break, we were talking about how you go about finding representation or an attorney or mediator. And so I think there might be some parallels that for therapy, the best referral tends to be word of mouth. Someone that you know that has worked with someone and can say, hey, this person's really good. So how does that work for working through divorce, Ross?
Yeah. So again, I have the attorney's experience, not the client experience here, but I will say the most important thing if you're talking to a couple lawyers and you're trying to pick between them, I think the most important thing, frankly, is your gut instinct. Like, do you trust this person? Are you going to trust them with your future? Do you trust them to look out for your kid? Those are big questions. Divorce inevitably involves a ton of information. You know, I have this speech I give every client about confidentiality and how it works and that I need them to be honest with me. And that's the information and advice I get is only as good as what they give me. You want that for sure. The other thing I'll say is I think word of mouth and reputation are important. The thing that lawyers are not like engineers, right? Like two lawyers who take the same inputs and the same facts do not necessarily get the same result. Mm-hmm. This drives some of my law students crazy. I also teach at UK a couple of days a week, and my law students who've like been engineering majors or science majors, it blows their mind. I had this girl last week, and she's a brilliant kid. She said, but what's the right answer? And there's no right answer. We need you to defend your answer, whatever it is. And so I think listening in your community to what people, has someone liked working with that person before? What was their experience? Mm-hmm. Those things are really crucial.
So the difference between, read some of these, responses I got, but how do couples know whether they need mediation or they need to lawyer up?
So from my perspective, I do about half of my practice I spend representing folks, and about half my time I spend mediating disputes. And so the thing to know is that mediation, that option is always going to be on the table. That's what I tell people. You can try it at the beginning, you can try it at the end. Where I practice, a judge is going to make you try it at some point, so you can try it whenever you want to try it. What I will say is this, for a mediation to be successful, everybody has to have the same information. There really needs to be equal access to the information. There needs to be a shared understanding of the family's finances, a shared understanding of the children, sort of their needs. So the flags might be if you have one spouse who owns a business and the other spouse has no idea where they bank, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah. and that's okay. In a marriage, you people find their own roles and they find what they're good at and you divide the labor. But if it means they're going to come in with really different information, mediations, my sense is those are the mediations that tend not to result in an agreement.
And so I guess I should ask, I assume not everybody may know what mediation is. So what is mediation? What is mediation? How does that fit in this whole process?
Sure. So mediation is, long story short, is it's an opportunity for two people who are having some kind of dispute, whether it's a divorce, a custody dispute, whatever, to see if there's an agreement they can reach about how to go forward without having a judge decide. So when I'm talking to people about mediation, I say the deal is you're still in control. If you two can say yes or no to offers, you can make proposals, you can say yes or no to them, but the end result is something both of them agree on. the other option, if you go to court, is you give up all the power in that room immediately to a stranger in a black robe. You just hand it over. Because if you don't, you know, if your ex is saying, hey, will you agree to take the child on every other weekend and pay me $500 a month? You can say yes or no. When a judge says you're going to have your child every other weekend and pay $500 a month, you don't get to say no. You don't get, you don't get to veto.
There's no negotiation.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, like, from your experience, just kind of finger in the wind here, how many divorces work without, within the mediation process without taking the next step?
Sure. I would say the majority, well, so COVID has done a little number on this, but even outside of COVID, here where I practice, the majority of our cases were resolved outside of court without a final hearing. Now, with mediation, Now, we have a very pro-mediation kind of culture here in Fayette County. You know, we respect individuals as individuals. You know, people around here really value autonomy. You know, sort of our culture is part of that. But I think the when COVID, that number's got to be 90% or higher. It's just nobody wants to wait for a hearing date. They can't get into the courthouse for 18 months. They don't whatever their ex is offering, they want done, right? They want done enough to not risk waiting all that time.
In those cases where they do end up going to court, like, does it seem like they're just so, like, they just can't figure out how to talk to each other? Like, what do those cases look like?
Yeah, that's such a great question. So no one can talk to each other. I don't mean to show my own bias, but people come in and like, we can't mediate. We don't trust each other. There's never trust. There's never communication. That's why they're here. Like, I can work with that all day. I think the cases that, you know, any case where there's an abuse allegation, those folks are in court. I will say where there's some just really untreated mental health issues or, you know, issues that people just have, are not in control of themselves. Those end up in court. And then frankly, and this is probably going to get me in trouble, but the truth is very, very wealthy people end up in court because they have the financial wherewithal to get through the process. And they just have the resources to spend on it. And, you know, I love my middle class, my mostly middle class practice, because people have to at some point solve their own problems because they can't keep paying me to do it.
That's right.
And so are the things that typically hang up a mediation, are they usually like asset related, like retirement or property? What kind of things typically end up causing mediation to stop?
I will say for me, and this is, again, my own experience, and I'm thinking just through what I'm thinking through the last month or 6 weeks or so on my schedule. I actually think the asset issues are easier to solve for the most part. In my practice, where mediation is falling apart, it's usually a custody or time-sharing issue because it's hard for people to figure out what the alternative is, right? If people are dividing $100,000 and they know, you know, the judge is going to get it within this $10,000 range and they know when they're in the ballpark, you know, when you've got a controversy like whether to vaccinate your child. That's something we're mediating all the time right now. You got one parent who wants to and one parent who doesn't, and they're in litigation about that. They don't know. There's no way to like quantify that and say, well, I can pay my attorney, you know, in a money dispute. And can I tell one story? This is kind of funny.
Absolutely.
I was meeting yesterday and there's a brilliant young attorney on one side and she just made partner at her firm and she's just rocking out here. And I probably shouldn't name her. I almost sound like I have a favorite, but she's really great here and like absolutely phenomenal. And the other side had made an offer and the client didn't really like it, but she's kind of right on the fence. And the attorney said to her client, she said, listen, Ross and I have told you the pros and cons of going to court a million times. You're just gonna have to figure this. You have to decide if this is close enough for you or not. And the client paused a minute and she said, am I paying your new partner rate today? And the attorney said, yeah. And she said, we'll take this offer.
Wow.
Because it was a math problem and she could do the math, right? And it's hard to know. There's no math problem with your kid, right? Your child is your child. And so those are the cases that are hard.
So, you know, one of the things we'll probably get into is working through mediation, divorce when different states or jurisdictions are involved. And so, and that's probably the thing I see most often is, so I guess just off the top of your head, or based on what you know, are there vast differences in custody decisions from state to state in terms of how states do it?
Oh yeah,
absolutely. And say like, what are the biggest contrasts?
Sure. So a lot of states, Kentucky is one of them. We were an early state on this. We start from the presumption that both parents will have equal time sharing and equal decision making for their child. That is a newer phenomenon. We were one of the first states to go there. Other states have no such presumption. And so the biggest thing, like, that is the biggest thing people, I do this a fair amount. I've got some friends in other states. So I have a fair number of calls where somebody will be in a consultation in say Missouri or someplace. And the lawyer will call me and say, hey, here's what we're thinking the Missouri read on this is going to be. Can you give us the Kentucky read? And of course, you always answer that call, right? Because that call is great for business. And then I will say, if it's a custody thing right now, if you've got dads especially, but if you've got a parent who really wants that equal time, they're almost always picking here. And if you've got a parent who really doesn't, if they're just convinced that they are the better parent and they're going to be able to get most of the time with their child, they don't come here. And so it's really pretty wild. And of course the kid has no say in this, right? I mean, the child's not even in on the call.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is the biggest difference in my life right now.
You know, we're up against Woman and Insight for a break, but you know, that's one of the interesting things that comes up quite a bit with custody. And maybe, you know, I don't think a ton of people know, like, what's this look like if, equal does not work out, and say a parent is not functioning responsibly. Mm-hmm. And so then what does that process look like to, I don't know whether it's in parental rights or what that looks like. We can jump into that when we come back. You're listening to Paradigm, Insights into Relationships and You. I'm your host, Toby Jenkins. Today, my guests is Ross Ewing and Sean Morrison, and we're talking about this. We'll be right back. This is Toby Jenkins, host of Paradigm, Insights into Relationships in You, and this is Woman in Insight. One aspect of being in the sandwich generation, and as a reminder, being in the sandwich generation means that you are in your 30s, 40s, or 50s, either partnered or not, and you're taking care of aging parents and children at the same time. But we hear the term managing boundaries quite often when we think about our relationships. And so I'll add to that, when it comes to being in the sandwich, prioritizing in order your relationships by importance is really important. And it doesn't mean that we are neglecting any of these relationships, but it gives us a way to manage when two or three things happen at the same time and what decision we make. Because often we try to split the hair and everyone's disappointed. So my recommendation typically is that we prioritize our partner relationship, then our relationship with our children, then our relationship and care for our parents. That may sound cruel, but it gives some clarity when you are hit with multiple things at the same time. This is Toby Jenkins, host of Paradigm, Insights into Relationships and You. One of the biggest stressors that we encounter is money. Money issues strain our family life, create stress in our relationships, and can provoke serious anxiety and depression, and many don't know where to turn to get relief. That's where the Darius Norman Show comes in. The Darius Norman Show airs daily on WTTA FM 101.2 from 1 to 2 p.m. Darius Norman is a certified credit and financial counselor and author of Rewriting Financial Rules. It's his objective to empower others with educational tools and services to assist them in taking control of their financial and credit issues. Tune in to the Darius Norman Show on WTTA FM 101.2, and you can follow him on Twitter at the Darius Norman Show. We are back. You are listening to Paradigm, Insights into Relationships and You. Today, my guest is Ross Ewing. He practices family law out of Lexington, Kentucky, and Shine the Chef. And before the break, we're talking about custody because that tends to be one of the pricklier things to work through. And so Ross, you were saying before the break, you know, Kentucky is a 50-50 state. in terms both parents get each get equal time. So where do I start? So from a therapy standpoint, one of those arrangements tend to be a 4-3. You know, the kids spend 4 days this week with one parent, 3 days the next week with the other parent. And I guess from a therapy standpoint, that tends to introduce, it seems like, a lot of chaos, especially when the home environments are very, very different. And then if you've got kids that are very active in other activities, it can create a logistics kind of, I don't know. So, and I know in principle it makes a lot of sense, but how does, what an ideal custody situation, what should that look like? Or what are the best practices?
Sure. Well, so, because we are a state that presumes joint custody and equal time, we have a lot of different ways we do it. And it'll be different for every kid and different for every family, but typically younger children do the schedule where there's a little bit more back and forth, right? I am told, and Toby, you're obviously the expert on this, I'm told there's some research that suggests that those younger kids need more frequent interactions with each of their parents, not necessarily longer ones, that there's something about the development of the bond or something about what's going on with them psychologically that they want to see the parents more. The reality is that parents of young kids don't want to go more than 2 days without seeing them.
Yeah.
Right. And so actually the big driver of a lot of this is how long mom or dad feels like they can go at a time without having their child next to them. Mm-hmm. And so that drives a lot of it. With younger kids, we'll often see a schedule where, maybe every Monday, Tuesday, the child is with dad, every Wednesday, Thursday, they're with mom, and then they rotate the weekend. So, and my own belief is that whatever schedule a child is on, the child needs to be able to understand it and internalize mm-hmm. it. And I think every kid on the planet who goes back and forth between two houses should be able to know at any time what day it is and where they're going. And so a simple schedule like that, especially with younger kids, tends to go better. A lot of people mm-hmm. here in Fayette County like that. The problem with that is that it does create a 5-day window. When you combine your weekend with your 2 days a week, you get this 5-day window. And sometimes people say, I don't want to go 5 days. And so they'll do the same thing, but they'll flop who's Monday and Tuesday every week.
Gotcha.
And so that's a lot of back and forth. So it's a trade-off there. Like if you want more frequency of contact, there's necessarily going to be more back and forth. And then typically the older kids move more towards the week on, week off. And then frankly, when they get to be teenagers, it's just a chauffeur job. You're not actually spending any time with them anyway. So
right.
They're fighting over who has to do it, actually. So.
Right, right. One of the things from a therapy standpoint, I'm thinking through some of the families that I work with. So this works ideally if once the parents have separate households, things are fairly consistent. And so, one of the things that I emphasize in therapy is that, your marital relationship may not work anymore, but your co-parenting relationship has to work.
Has to
be consistent. And so some of the worst case scenarios I see, and you've probably seen a ton of these too, where basically the parents don't talk anymore and they can't talk anymore. And it's just to exaggerate a little bit, it's a party, good time for the kids at one parent's house, and it's discipline, homework at the other parent's house. As kids get older, they exploit that.
That's right. They absolutely will try.
Yes. Yes.
You sound like you know something about this, Sean.
My kids tried it for like a brief second, right? Yeah. Because I'm a lot more lax than their mom in terms of, I'm like, listen, do what you're supposed to do so you can do what you want to do. Right. And, they're teenagers now, and I'm trying to teach them, hey, your decisions that you make are going to have consequences. Right. So I'm like, okay, you don't want to do your schoolwork? Fine. Right. It's going to cost you. Right. Yeah. Because what am I going to do? I can't beat it out of you. I even tried it, like take everything away. It doesn't work. Right. Kids, my son, for example, he was like, yeah, whatever. Right. I'll just wait. Right. I'll just wait. Mm-hmm. Right. So he's smarter. So I was like, okay, fine. understand that each, you know, these things are going to have consequences, but like, it didn't take long before it really didn't, you know, it was just kind of them testing the waters. Mm-hmm. Right. And so they know that they can't, I'm not a pushover. I just have a different method of dealing with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And does that create tension between you and your ex-wife?
No, I think, so my kids started, once we were divorced, my kids started to see me more, mm-hmm. right? Because when we were together, they didn't realize that me and their mom would talk about things. It just seemed like she was more of the enforcer because I was working mm-hmm. or doing other things, like, and she was more tied to them. So once they started to see me, they figured out, oh, you know, that he just has a different method. And he's, you know, we have a more open relationship. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of treat them like young adults, and I talk to them very directly, and I teach them, I don't just tell them no. I explain to them why I'm saying no. And mm-hmm. for them to, and I'll ask questions. So what do you think about this? Or what, you know, do you think that this makes sense, to try to help them understand how to do some reasoning and apply some logic in situations so that they know how to go out and say, wait a minute, hey, does this make sense? Am I doing the right thing? And that kind of thing. So it's just a little bit different. Their mom, sometimes she's a little less vocal in that way. And sure. more of the old school, like, do because I said so. Not all the time, but like, you know, sometimes she doesn't give as much of an explanation right behind yeah. it. And nowadays, the way kids are, like, you really got to get into their heads and help them understand what's going on because they have access to so much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So like the other kind of questions around custody that I commonly see too. One, you mentioned earlier that custody. So I'm assuming that the state you get divorced in, those custody guidelines apply. Do they apply if the whole family moves?
Oh, that is, you're gonna get my law school teacher in here, but so oh, they,
so here's the second part. So here's yeah, the second yeah. part too. The second part is, I also see where a lot of parents make the choice after a divorce to stay in the same location. Mm-hmm. Every now and then one will say, "Ooh, I got this job opportunity," or whatever reason to move. And what does that do to custody arrangements? So those are my two questions about custody. Oof.
All right, cool. Well, I will just say that again, if anybody's listening to this, if you have an issue that involves which state's rules apply, please talk to a lawyer. Like, this is mm-hmm. not, that is a tricky, tricky, tangly, like, it's actually on the bar exam. And sometimes people don't pass the bar exam because they can't get this stuff right. So like, wow. it's a tricky issue. So, but with that said, generally speaking, once one state, so 49 of the states had the same rule about this. It's actually kind of, there's an interesting history there sometime, but you know, in the 90s, Congress said, hey, states, if you want some federal money for your child support and other programs, you all need to get on the same page about this. And they said, you must all pass the same law. And everybody in Massachusetts did it. I don't know why Massachusetts didn't. We can call them and ask, but everybody else did. And so the, so once a state has made a decision, if anybody stays in that state keeps having decision-making power. So if you start moving, if you start breaking people up, if you start moving people around, the first state to act, their rules still apply until they decide they don't, or it would be inconvenient, or everybody's gone. So
are you saying that, okay, so if I'm in North Carolina,
yeah,
and my potential ex is in Virginia, if I were to initiate the divorce, then it's based on North Carolina law.
Very likely. As long as the child had been in North Carolina at some point with you, and had been there maybe 6 months or 6 months okay. was kind of the magic window. So when you're first making a decision, you look where has the child been for 6 months, and then some different rules apply if you want to change that later to one.
So what have we been 50-50 for those 6 months? Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do we do then? Is it just I can't count? Well, I guess you could kind of try to count down to the hour, but I mean, like, really, is that just a judgment call or?
Yeah. People count their overnights and they race to the courthouse. That's why, if you've got a choice, you want to try to get information about both states. So if you've got, you know, if you've got a kid who's been flying back and forth between North Carolina and Kentucky, or especially if California and Kentucky, something like that, you want to get information about both places before you take any action, because you really are going to be stuck with it very potentially.
And so if I'm smart, potentially, I don't know if this is right or wrong.
Yeah.
I could look at both states' laws and as a father say, okay, let me pick whichever one is going to be more in my favor.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then you could manipulate the situation to say, you know, that state where the mom is, that state's actually a little better for me. So I'm going to go up there to do my visits the next couple months so that we don't have any question that that's the state where this child's been for 6 months.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Yeah. Interesting.
I actually work with some clients that are in that very similar situation. The father is back in Kentucky. The mother has moved to actually Virginia. And I think they, this is something I also want to talk about too, maybe after the next break. You know, there's a population that has money to throw at this, and there's a population mm-hmm. that doesn't.
Absolutely.
And the kind of the, I hate to say it, that some of the arrangements these people end up in, but you know, this family or this, these parents were kind of working on, I'm assuming, was kind of an informal agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked fine, I think, for about 10 years.
Yep.
Then just out of the blue, he got child support papers like 2 weeks ago. So that's another thing kind of in the divorce 101, difference between alimony, how that's figured out, child support, how that's figured mm-hmm. out. But we can jump into that after this next break. You're listening to Paradigm, Insights into Relationships and You. We'll be right back.
You've got mail. You've got mail.
This is from Clara. All right. Today's listener mail comes from Clara. I lost my mother to breast cancer 9 months ago, and I can't seem to get over it. I can't stop thinking about her or feeling really, really sad daily about not being able to talk to her. I really, really miss her. Is this normal to feel this way 9 months after losing someone? Either one of you can jump. What would you say as a therapist?
I mean, I would say that it's normal, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that there, you know, as a therapist, I would try to give her some tools and some things to think about to, you know, understand the grieving process and how she can start to work through that and understand that you will always, quote unquote, miss them. Right. Mm-hmm. It's how you navigate through that on a daily basis and not let it completely paralyze you. If that's the case, or like, you know, whatever that case may be, like, you know, and just holding on to that and allowing yourself to stay in that space and looking at why, you know, you continue, you know? So, I mean, that would be my first inclination.
Oh, cool. How about you, Ross? If you played therapist with this listener.
Yeah, let me tell you, I don't have the right letters after my name to answer this question. I will say, I mean, my answer is, of course it is. I mean, you know, I have not lost a parent. My parents have lost parents. And if my mm-hmm. mother were here, she would say, there's not a day that goes by I don't think about my dad. I love yep. my dad. You know, mm-hmm. that's great. And, you know, he's living on in that memory. That's cool. But, you know, looking at why it's taking the shape it's taking and whether it's helping you, you know, is from my perspective, is it helpful for it to still be that way? Is there another way it could be more helpful for you? That's what I would encourage that person to think about.
You guys are good. Those are good answers. You know, the only thing I would add to that is I'm going to plug a book, which I've used the premise of this book quite a bit. It's the premise of Ambiguous Loss. I can't remember the author's name, but she recently wrote a book called The Myth of Closure. And so the concept behind it is that we assume that we get closure on certain losses and then we'll be okay. But it could be possible that we don't get closure or get over it. We just learn to live with it. And cool. So kind of like what you said, Ross, when you lose someone, it's natural to think about them daily. It's hopeful that at some point it won't make you as sad as often. But you know, it's kind of the downside of loving somebody. You're going to lose them eventually, is the sad truth. So.
Don't touch that dial. We'll be right back with more Paradigm, insights into relationships and you with Toby Jenkins.
And we are back. You are listening to Paradigm Insights into Relationships and You. Today we're talking divorce, sticky topic. My guest is Ross Ewing, family law attorney in Kentucky, and Shine the Chef. So, we're talking quite a bit about some of the complications with custody arrangements. Just kind of like back in, to kind of from definition, what is alimony? What is child support? How are those things determined in the process of going through a divorce? And is that something that couples can work through in mediation?
Sure. So both of those issues are going to be very specific to each state. Each state has its own child support formulas, and each state has its own rules about alimony, which here in Kentucky we call maintenance or maintenance. And the rules vary widely. I will just say, so I'll use my Kentucky example. We have no formula for alimony or maintenance. We have never had a formula. There's no table. There's no guidelines. It's whatever the judge thinks based on the facts of the case.
Really?
It is. It still is. Wow. This same time, we just updated our child support guidelines for the first time since 1991 or two, and those guidelines were based on 1987 cost of living data.
Wow.
So we were way overdue on some of that stuff. So both of them vary widely by state. Absolutely. So talk to a lawyer ASAP if you're worried about calculating your child support or alimony.
Alimony is what?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Yeah. So alimony or maintenance is a payment from one ex-spouse to another. In Kentucky, it's designed to be rehabilitative. So if at the end of a divorce process, you have one spouse who cannot meet their own reasonable needs through their employment or through the property they've been awarded, the court may say the other spouse has to pay them some money for whatever period of time. So the classic example is in a very long-term marriage. Let's say, I'm going to be sexist for a minute, but you have a wife who gave up a career to raise children, and the children are grown, so she's not going to get any child support, and there's some assets to divide, but maybe she's reentering the workforce at Macy's, rather than in a publishing career. Mm-hmm. And she needs some help to get her career restarted or get back on her own feet. That's the classic example.
What's a reasonable time frame for that though? When you say rehabilitative, because I think that could promote some slow growth, let's say.
So that's the fear, right? Absolutely, that's the fear. And so that's one side of it. The other side of it is that getting back in the workforce is hard. Like, it's for real hard. There's no two cents about that. No two ways about it. But again, in Kentucky, we don't have a formula. One of my mentors, because we didn't have, he's a guy who's now passed away, his name was Judge Keller, Judge James Keller here in Lexington, great guy. He, because we didn't have a formula, he would survey every single case he could find, published or unpublished, about maintenance. And every year he would give it to the bar and just show people what they were doing. And I've tried to keep that tradition going in my practice since he passed. But what we find is that in Kentucky, generally speaking, maintenance ends up lasting somewhere from like 20 to 30% of the length of the marriage. So if you were married for 10 years, maybe somebody will get 3 years to get back on their feet, something like that. So what I will say from my perspective is, the more, if I have somebody who wants spousal maintenance, wants alimony, the best thing I can do for them is say, we need to show a very specific plan about, for you, do you need to finish that bachelor's degree? Does that take 18 months and cost how much money?
That's a beautiful thing.
So we come in, when I'm doing it, I come in with a very specific proposal. And I say, Judge, my client is waiting on tables right now. She can get this coding degree and do medical coding. She needs 24 months and she needs, however much money per month to make the bills meet. And she needs him to pay the cost of this class she needs for that license. And that almost always works, because the guy who would pay it is always fine with that, right? Like, he's always like, okay, cool, that makes sense. When you come in and you just say, Judge, I need you to take care of me for life, that doesn't always go so well.
Yeah. So do they consider, do they take into account like livable wage, like as a versus I mean, you know, like you said, you mentioned waiting tables. Like, what's the cutoff there in terms of like saying, hey, you know, you can probably make it on your own?
Yeah, it's hard, right? So it varies for each case. The standard of living during the marriage matters a little bit. Frankly, the judge's opinions about it matter a little bit. I was in court not too long ago, and the person was saying, I need maintenance. I only make $50,000 a year. And the judge was going, some of these attorneys in front of me aren't making that, you know, some of the county attorneys and the public defenders aren't making what you make. You know, lots of people in this county can live off of $50,000 a year.
Yeah.
And so the personality of the judge matters quite a bit in this one.
Yeah. Cause what I've seen is in I think my case and several of my friends, because maybe the spouse made less, and they lived at a certain amount, let's say lifestyle, initially they're scared.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So they're like, no, I need like $1,000 a month. I'm like, hold on. Like, really, do you need, like, you know, whatever that number is. And it's like, man, like, if I give you that, how do you expect me to live, or whatever the case may be? Right. You know what I'm saying?
Well, and the ability to pay is relevant. So we have a funny old quote from an old case in Kentucky that says that we have maintenance so that the Duchess does not become a scullery maid, right? These old English titles of nobility, right? And so when I was teaching my students about this recently, I was saying, like, think about it. We struggle with that. Like, a duchess, like, who are the duchesses? Like, we're talking about like Duchess Kate. Like, we're talking about like married to a prince. We're talking like way, way, way up there. And so I was asking, like, who are they in America? And the person was saying they're Kardashians, you know, Ivanka Trump, like Bill Gates. I mean, they're these really, really wealthy women. And so obviously they are not going to wait tables, right? If they've been married for 30 years and been doing that. But I think, and I probably venturing my own opinion about this too much, you know, having to go from shopping at Kohl's to shopping at Target is not quite the same thing, right? Like, because you can never maintain the same standard in two households using the same income. You just can't. The economy and scale don't work that way. And so I probably said too much there, but
no, I think that's great.
No, that's and so it's interesting because this applies when there's a huge income inequity. And so when there isn't inequity, then there's no alimony or maintenance, right?
Very rarely. Again, I'm in Kentucky, so our law is we're kind of the Wild West on this. But if you looked at states that had really good formulas, if their people are making similar income, this is just not a conversation they have.
Yeah. And so then child support, in its name is, you know, self-explanatory. How is that determined?
Sure. So every state has to have child support guidelines. The interesting thing is that until next month, the guidelines in my state do not take into account the amount of time each parent spends with the child. So like, you know, we had all these child support laws from the 80s and 90s, but guess what? Like, dads didn't see their kids in the 80s and 90s, right? Mm-hmm. At least not the way that they do now. And so for the longest time, when we started this presumption in Kentucky that everybody would have 50-50 time, we had no law on what that meant for child support. We didn't. The legislature passed one without the other. So we've been struggling with that for a long time. That's kind of the hot thing happening in child support land right now is what, you know, how do you factor in time? You know, maybe we've got this data that says, you know, it costs $800 a month to raise a kid if everybody makes this amount of money. But what if you've got the kid half the time, you know, or.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sitting here like, hey, I get the kids half the time. I have to feed, clothe half the time. So why am I paying? Right? You get what I'm saying? Like, it's like, well, there's no loss here, or there's no, like, nobody's winning more than the other in that case to me.
Yeah.
Right. So it's kind of like, I mean, I know we did our own agreement and all that, but like, looking back on it, I'm like, hey man, I don't know about this. Like, this doesn't look right.
Yeah. Yeah. So the idea of child support, when it comes right down to it, and it, you know, pop culture child support has a lot of bad rap for a lot of reasons, kind of like attorneys. We have a bad rap for a bad reason, for a lot of reasons. But at bottom is the idea that the, you know, your child's daily life standard of living should not suffer because you and your ex can't get along anymore, right? So, you know, you don't want a kid going hungry because mommy and daddy can't get along anymore. And let's say mommy makes a bunch of money and daddy doesn't. And, you know, you don't want that child to suffer. Now, what Sean hit on so correctly is that some of those expenses you have in both houses, right? Like you got to keep heat on, you got to keep electric on in both those houses, you got to keep a bed in both of those houses. And some of those expenses don't. Some of those expenses like baseball cleats can go back and forth, or, you know, the baseball bat, whatever other expenses kids have can go back and forth. And so we're really figuring that out still, is sort of what that looks like in this modern time when kids still have two active parents.
And, you know, to go to your point, Sean, I also see from a therapy standpoint, parents keeping every receipt.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
Accounting every penny and making sure that they get their money, you know, they're not paying any more than they should. But, you know, in these kinds of situations, the kid ends up paying.
Yeah.
Yes, especially if they witness any of this. I mean, oh my gosh, it drives the judges crazy. It drives me crazy. It drives everybody in family law crazy when they find out that, you know, the child brought dad's payment, child support payment to mom on time sharing, or that they fought about it in front of the child. And there's some apps and some other things out there these days that are helping with that some. You know, there's some apps on your phone where you can keep track of the payments, and like not quite Venmo, but they have built-in payment systems. What I do like about that is unless you're giving your child the phone, which is a whole other conversation, you know, they're not seeing that. Mom and dad are doing it. Right. They're seeing mom or dad send an angry text, maybe, but that's nothing unusual. Jeez.
So Ross, you are running at the moment unopposed to be the family court judge in Lexington.
Yes, sir.
And so why would you want to? No, just kidding.
No, it's a fair question. So my first job right out of law school, I worked for a judge who's now retired, and then I went out into practice for myself. So I have some idea of what I'm getting myself into. Yeah. I know it's a lonely job. I know it's unglamorous. You know, at the end of the day, the real answer is that about a year ago, my dad had a pretty big heart attack, and I got to thinking about how I wanted to spend whatever time I got. You know, when he was in the hospital, my mom made this offhanded comment about how the Ewing men don't last very long. And I went and consulted the family tree and thought, oh my God, she's not lying. This is wild. I got to think about just kind of what I wanted to do. And I'm not bored practicing law. I like my practice. I like mediating. I just feel like I've kind of had I've made the kinds of difference I can make already. You know, I teach, I've made new law. I've made new cases. I've written court rules no one follows. I've got to help a bunch of people. And, you know, I just want to try to have a different impact, or have an impact in a different way.
That's awesome. Actually. It's a hard job, a needed job. Many of the resources involved in family court are understaffed and underfunded. And like you said, you can really make a difference there. Cause you know, I kind of jokingly said it, but when you do your job well, no one will know. But if you make a controversial decision, everybody will be pissed off with you, unhappy with the decision. It's a hard job, and hats off to you for taking this on and making a difference with it. You're going to be good at it.
Oh, I appreciate that.
That's pretty good. That's awesome, actually. So this concludes part one of Divorce 101, or in other words, marriage therapy didn't work. So now it's time to end this with Ross Ewing, family law attorney, and Shine the Chef. So next week, we're going to jump into some of the pricklier issues with divorce. Let's say if you're not married and cohabitating, prenups, postnups, child support, alimony. So come back next week. It's going to be good. On the air, email me at Toby at ParadigmRadioShow.com. You can find archive shows and additional details about guests of the show at the show's website, www.paradigmradioshow.com. You can follow weekly 1 Minute Insight posts on the show's Instagram and Twitter feed at Paradigm Radio Show. For archived episodes, you can find episodes wherever you subscribe to podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. Paradigm, Insights into Relationships and You, is brought to you by Jenkins Professional Services and Hype Media Global.
Thank you for tuning into Paradigm, Insights into Relationships and You with Toby Jenkins. Join us again